Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Wow, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. It is a massive, historic day. October 3rd, 2024. Your Supporters Shield champions are, drumroll please, Inter Miami, Lionel Messi. Doyle lifting that beautiful, shiny dinner plate high above his head, celebrating with his teammates. Jorge Mas making speeches. How does it make you feel, you old Shield truther, you, to see Messi, the legend, lift and value and truly appreciate this thing that is so near and dear to your heart?
It makes me feel very, very good to see the greatest player of all time clearly jacked by the fact that he led his team to a Supporters Shield triumph. It is something that I've thought about since like the start of MLS. Like, what will it feel like when the best players in the world are here? And we're starting to get a trickle of that, obviously. And look, I've made my stance clear on the Supporters Shield for a long time. As someone who watches every single week like it's the playoffs, right? Who consumes these games from February to December and is locked in for all of it. The thing I value most are the teams that bring it every single week, that make you care, that try to perform their absolute best and don't take games off. And Miami have epitomized that, and they've epitomized it 1-30 on that roster, which we're going to get into in a little bit. And the culmination is them winning at this fortress in Columbus against what I think is one of the best teams of all time, though we have to revisit my take that they're the best team of all time, obviously. And doing it with the GOAT putting in a time capsule performance and hoisting that dinner plate. It's awesome. It's awesome. It's what I've wanted for a quarter century or more. And we got a great example of it last night.
There's a big part of me that really wishes, and look, this could come to fruition.
It really wishes that Kalen Carr was on this show.
I wasn't going to mention the blood curdling scream that I heard last night somewhere in Toronto. And it carried over. The decibel level was that high. The anguish that I felt from afar, it was almost telepathic between myself and Kalen, of just like, no, MLS Cup is the true prize. Messi, it's not over for you, but I wish it was kind of like the Stanley Cup. I wish that the Supporters Shield was both celebrated, but a la the Philadelphia Union a few years ago, could be masquerade as a shield. It could be used for charcuterie. It could be used as, something to serve a PB&J and some chips on for lunch for Messi's kids. It could have a practical use and appreciation in addition to representing and valuing brilliance over the course of months and months and games and injuries and changes and challenges and absences and everything that goes into the blender that you have to deal with to come out on the other side, champions of the Supporters Shield. It was special. It was special. The night, the game, the GOAT, the way he seemed to react, and we'll get to that in just a second. Elsewhere around the league, and we'll run you through all this stuff throughout the show. Two more teams are into the playoffs. Charlotte and Minnesota have booked their spots in the postseason. FC Dallas are officially out of this thing, which means the Western Conference has one spot remaining, but that's really just on very far-fetched math. Almost certainly the top nine teams will remain the top nine teams, just depending on seeding. And that means the big story heading into the final two match days, well, three, I guess, because the international break of the season, is those remaining wild card spots, in the Eastern Conference. So before we get to Inter Miami and the Columbus Crew and this wonderful match and the Supporters Shield and what it means and whether or not Lionel Messi should or will be MVP, let's give the rest of the league a nice palate cleanser. Doyle, give me your non-Miami, non-crew best thing you saw from the Wednesday match day.
Pauly Primetime. Paul Rothrock out in Seattle. He's become one of the best under the radar stories of the year. He's on his way to, it seems, becoming a Cascadia Cup legend for the Sounders, a throwback kind of like Roger Levesque, Mike Fecito era type of guy.
But, maybe come on, even, that's like kind of, no offense, love both of them. That might not be doing Rothrock anywhere close to justice for his performance and just for the trajectory that he is on.
He's more than he's more than just a cult hero at this point. He drew a penalty and scored a goal last night. Did he have an assist too? I don't remember if he had an assist, but he was awesome coming in off of either wing, and he could play on either wing. It might be Lamar Nagel, and I think you added that to the rundown.
I did.
It feels like that level of player, and for a couple years, remember Lamar Nagel? Like, he was the third best attacker on the Shield
Obadus. On the Obadus teams
in 2014. Look, he's 25 years old. He was supposed to be a lifer in the lower divisions, and he ended up winning a job early on in this season, and he has grabbed it with both hands, and he has kept it. And a couple of folks I follow on social media, my good friend Kieran Doyle, and then Caleb Wilkins. Kieran is a Toronto guy, and Caleb is a Vancouver guy. And Caleb was pointing out that Toronto's narrative this season is that they're rebuilding, except they're playing guys who are mostly in their upper 20s and beyond.
They're playing the olds.
They're playing the olds. And then Kieran pointed out that Paul Rothrock, 2 years ago, he was arguably the best player in MLS Next Pro for TFC2. And they let him walk for nothing. And he ended up in the Sounders system. And the Sounders are a more forward-thinking club when it comes to developing players, both academy players, and we're seeing that with Obed Vargas and Josh Atencio and obviously Jordan Morris. They're also forward-thinking when it comes to using their Next Pro guys. And it wasn't just Rothrock. It was Georgie Manungo on the other side of that 4-2-3-1 on the opposite wing. And Manungo was awesome last night as well, as they went to Vancouver, who are a good team, and they just thumped them. I know you are maybe the only person in the world who loves these developmental stories as much as I do. I think it's so crucial for MLS to get to the level we all collectively want to see the league at. And if it wasn't for what Inter Miami have done with their homegrowns and draft picks, Seattle would be the shining example of it this year.
Do Vancouver have a homegrown of note? I'm racking my brain other than Alfonso Davies and coming up relatively empty.
Yeah, I can't, like,
Ali Ahmed
is there, yeah. But he's another TFC refugee, right?
Ah, man, it just feels like there's something missing there. And I only make that reference because this is a game in which the Sounders go to Vancouver with Cascadia Cup on the line and handle the Whitecaps. I mean,
Ali Ahmed is actually
okay,
from Toronto, but he ended up, no, he went on trial with the TFC Youth Academy in 2018.
I mean, and look, Alfonso Davies is a guy that was recruited into the academy as well from Edmonton, if I remember.
We want to see the Vancouver Whitecaps do more with their academy kids,
correct,
with their local kids. There's always been a ton of talent coming out of British Columbia and, you know, the surrounding areas, and they just it's one of the things that has been a little bit disappointing about this otherwise very successful by their standards era.
We will get to the Whitecaps in a little more depth in a bit. They did blow an opportunity at home against these Sounders to seal the Cascadia Cup for 2024. That trophy will now be decided on Decision Day in Seattle, I believe, with Portland in town. So that's a big one to circle for October 19th. Just to wrap up your point here, Doyle, about rooting for guys who come from, I don't know, less than sort of idyllic pathways, a la Alfonso Davies, where it's like, I'm a prodigy. I thrive at the second team. I jump into the first team. I pop off immediately. I'm into the national team. I go to Europe. I'm playing at the biggest clubs in the world. Like, there's a reason why Paddy Agyeman is a guy that I root for with abandon in this league. There's a reason why I am juiced to get this Max Arfston jersey that I just received from the crew that he signed up on my wall. There's a reason why Paul Rothrock is identifiable and loved by so many Sounders fans already. And it's because you can sort of see yourself in them of like, oh yeah, I probably wasn't supposed to make it. Good players, local guys, got a break, took advantage of that break. It's just easy to root for. It's really fun. What can't be easy to root for right now, and this is my best thing I saw, because I often think the best things are not always the most positive things because it's dramatic and entertaining, is the flip side of this is Federico Bernardeschi is basically, he's basically a mercenary for Toronto FC. Is that too harsh of a term?
I think so. Yeah, I need to hear more.
Okay. Most professional soccer players are mercenaries. Let's just put it that way. But Bernardeschi is making a lot of money in the middle of a playoff push for a guy like that to take two terrible yellow cards, the second of which being a Scarface and half-baked quitting the fast food restaurant, you know, F you, I'm out situation. That was a microcosm of everything that has gone wrong for Toronto. It was damning for Bernardeschi and the way he thinks about the club and the way he thinks about the project and the way he feels about what's happening right now at Toronto.
I'm going to interrupt you. Bernardeschi has spilled it all onto the field this year. This guy is by far the best player on the team, and he's playing a thankless two-way role, role as a wingback.
He's over it with everybody else. He looks around and says, nah, this ain't it. I'm not going to be a part of this.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think he lost his cool. I think he's understandably frustrated when you look at how poor the rest of that roster build is, when you look at how Lorenzo Insigne has not shown up this year. When you look at how Toronto have not developed any of the young players who they could have had their hands on, guys who are really good MLSers like Paul Rothrock and Ali Ahmed, who we just mentioned a second ago. It was a bad moment from Bernardeschi, and he should apologize to the fans. But this is not a Bernardeschi problem, what we've seen with Toronto. This is a Toronto FC problem. If there's one person you're going to keep beyond this year, well, two people, it's Bernardeschi and it's Jonathan Osorio. And the rest of it, I mean, might need a full teardown and fumigation, because it's been bad. And I don't think that calling Bernardeschi a mercenary for this is the right, I understood his frustration in that moment, even though I hated to see it. And he did let his team down. But if you look at the rest of the team, they've been letting him down for 6 months.
Okay, I'm going to take back mercenary, because I think you're exactly right on that point. That's too harsh, especially given the output and commitment that Bernardeschi has had this year in roles that we never would have imagined that he would embrace. And up and down the entire sideline fullback? Really? The amount of effort and commitment that takes? I just thought that that moment was emblematic of where this Toronto season is. And it's like into the darkness, my old friend. Like, remember the vibes early on with John Herdman and all the back padding that Toronto FC was doing about how they had turned it around and they were together and this was a culture and this was this, that, this, that, and the other. And it has just disintegrated. It has evaporated. And they are still in the playoff spots. They're ninth, 37 points. They have one game left at home against Miami. Obviously, Bernardeschi will not be available.
John Herdman said that Insigne might play 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah. Double calf strain, Doyle. What's the point? 5 or 10 minutes? What's the point?
I wouldn't play him.
These other guys are going to have to get it done. And even if they make the playoffs, do we have any faith that they can do anything? Absolutely not. There's just something amiss in Toronto. Anyway.
I mean, the only thing that could happen that could maybe make it interesting is if it's Montreal, Toronto in the 8-9 game, and maybe there's just a level of professional pride that comes through because you're playing a derby in the play-in game for the right to go face Messi. That is maybe
something
the
to
only
root for.
Yeah, there you go.
I have something that I'm absolutely rooting for, and it's exactly that, because I tweeted during the match tonight, hey, dark times in Toronto. basically the only people that replied to that were Toronto fans saying yes, and then by about a measure of three or four times, Montreal fans saying, oh yes, we love to see this. Actually, the best thing I saw in a positive way, but I guess there is a negative side of this. Joseph Martinez showing us the old Joseph Martinez in Atlanta to basically shatter the Five Stripes playoff hopes and probably, we'll see, but probably send Montreal to the playoffs. That's now five seasons of double-digit goals for Joseph in MLS, his first since 2021 with Atlanta. He got to the 10 mark. Both of the goals were just, if he was wearing black and red, I would believe it. Hey, Cameron. We can't play soccer in the basement while I'm taping a podcast. Sorry, folks. We've opened up half my basement to my son. He's off school today. And the word was, please play FIFA quietly. And we just can't stay away from smashing balls against the walls. So I love it. I love it. The amount of improvement we've seen in ball striking has been incredible. But we'll have to wait another hour before we do that. But anyway, Joseph's quote was, it's a little sad. And that has a lot of meanings, Doyle. It could go a lot of ways. I think he was saying it was a little sad for me to inflict this pain on the people in the club that is so close to my heart. But I think the flip side of it is Atlanta's state right now, also a little sad. But both those goals from Joseph, again, he's wearing black and, you know, red, and it's 2019. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Anyway,
it felt like a throwback performance from him, and he and Caden Clark and Bryce Duke and Nathan. Look, Montreal over the past month have somehow become one of the happier stories in MLS, and it looked like they were going to be a massive disappointment. I mean, remember a month ago, Laurent Courtois just raking Joseph over the coals in the press, saying like, this is not the man.
He's not committed. Yeah.
That he was at the start of the season, and something happened and they buried the hatchet, and he has been one of the best number nines in the league since that moment. And I'm with you, man. It looks like Montreal are going to make the playoffs in large part because of him.
Because of him. And I also got to call out all the young guys they picked up. They just collect these pieces and it's like, well, who's going to fit? How's it going to work? And all of a sudden the Caden Clarks of the world, the Bryce Dukes, Shaquille Marshall, Ruddy, you know, Opoku's, All these guys that have just sort of been collected, Nathan Saliba probably at the top of that class, are performing and thriving in starting roles. So well done, Montreal. I mean, it's not too little too late. It might be just enough, just in time. All right, Inter Miami, win the Shield. Let's do it, Doyle. And we're reading off predictions to start from the beginning of the season. Andrew Wiebe, fifth in the Eastern Conference. Wah, wah. Bradley Wright Phillips, fifth in the Eastern Conference. Wah, wah. Kalen Kyle, fifth in the Eastern Conference. Wah, wah. Sasha Kleshchen, fifth in the Eastern Conference. Wah, wah. Matt Doyle, Marcelo Balboa, Antonello Gonzalez, first in the Eastern Conference. Congratulations, Doyle. Take your victory lap. Just remember that this is a trophy for me, even though I didn't believe in Inter Miami via the trophy draft.
it was, which team has Lionel Messi? And oh, Luis Suarez was the best player in Brazil last year. And also they added a lot of depth. And Tata Martino, in terms of winning percentage, is by far the winningest coach in MLS history, with more than 20 games coached. It just, so many other things needed to go right for so many other teams. Like maybe if Columbus had gotten eliminated early in CCL, things would be different, maybe. But that didn't seem as good a bet as betting on Messi, Suarez, Busquets, and the rest. Was it just for you? Was it just like they're too old? I guess, like, I can't see fifth. I can't see how you get to fifth.
Yeah, I'm struggling to see how I got there as well. You know, if you work back, you're
all
in math
you,
class.
All
as a
you
kid,
guys,
and the teacher's no, like, you show all, your work. I don't know that I can show you my work. I mentally, I blanked it out.
You all drink the Kool-Aid about Suarez being done, right? Because remember last January, he was like, oh, I can't even move, and I have to take all these injections to even be able to get out of bed in the morning. It's like, bro, you had 26 goals and 17 assists in Brazil last year. I think you're okay. And then I think the other thing...
Well, the other thing was
everybody thought that this team was going to collapse in the summer when these guys were all gone at Copa 100%. America. And Taylor made the point last night that 9-game stretch without Messi, Miami won 8 of those.
Yeah. I mean, they won the Shield from basically beginning of June onward. They lost one game in that time. It was the beatdown against Cincinnati, but they basically were not perfect, but close to perfect in that sense. Here's where I would say my doubt came in. And if you go through their roster, there are a bunch of question marks that turned out to be massive positives that you couldn't have seen coming. Like, don't tell me that you saw Yannick Bright coming. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me you saw Leo Alfonso scoring game-winning goals in big moments to get 3 points that end up being crucial in this race. Don't tell me that you saw, in the biggest game of the season, Ian Frey and Noah Allen starting at center back and doing it credibly. Don't tell me you saw Matias Rojas getting signed or Freire getting injured and then getting replaced by David Martinez. Don't tell me that you saw Diego Gomez making a jump from, hey, that's a good player, to, hey, that's a guy that might play at the very highest level one day as beating Brazil in World Cup qualifiers. He looked like he was going to be a very, very good player, potentially great, but he hit at a different level this year. We didn't know what Redondo was going to be in this team. We didn't know if Taylor was
To be fair, when we made the predictions, we didn't know Redondo was going to be in the
exactly
team.
Exactly. There were a lot of things we didn't know. And also, I just think that I had more faith in the Cincinnati's, in the Columbuses of the world, certainly in Orlando, in LAFC. Well, LAFC's in the West, so never mind. That's not a legitimate argument. I don't know, Doyle. That's what I'm telling you. What I will tell you is this Shield, to me, is a representation, a personification of just unabashed, ambitious commitment to winning at basically any cost for Inter Miami. If you can come up with an excuse as to why you can't win or why you can't make this move or why this is just not possible for your team, for whatever reason, Miami did not accept any of those reasons. And people are going to sit at home and say, yeah, but they're in Miami. They're in Florida. There's no state income tax. You got Messi, so of course you got Suarez and you got Alba on TAM, and all these guys came to your team because you have Messi. And my challenge to that would be like, yeah, you got Messi. You think that's easy? You think that's free? You think that didn't take years and years and years of work and commitment and fill in the blank that nobody will ever know about but Messi and the Moss brothers to get that done, to create the trust that you have to have, in addition to making Messi basically a part of your ownership group going forward, which is a stroke of genius in its own right. Like, what Miami did is something that nobody else could do. Nobody else even imagined. And they said, you know what? To quote Moss, freedom of dream, baby. We're going to make it happen. And oh, by the way, we're going to make it happen the year after we spent 2 years eating sanctions for breaking the rules prior to that. So look, you can get mad about those sanctions, but they took their punishment and they built a roster that when Messi came in, Chris Henderson was able to mix and match. And I don't know, he's like an alchemist, Doyle. Figure out a way to get so much out of this team that like 30 players played in MLS. 21 had 5 starts or 500 plus minutes, from the DPs, the U22s, the TAM, to loan players, to free agent signings, to homegrowns, to super draft players, to other senior roster players. Everybody contributed at a high level, everybody. And that's how you win the Shield.
The one area that I'm going to push back, I think was probably a misstatement, you misspoke, was saying that only Miami could have done this. And I still think that the Los Angeles teams could have done this. I think that the New York teams could have done this. Arguably, maybe Toronto, Chicago, Atlanta, because those are all cities that are a draw, as well as big as Miami is a draw. So I think if we saw the same ambition from the Red Bulls or NYCFC, or, I mean, we're seeing something close to it from LAFC,
Especially if they go get Griezmann. If they get Griezmann.
Which they will. We're going to be talking about Griezmann next year.
You're correcting me, but I don't think it's... Like, I think there's a unique situation with Messi and the city in Miami.
Yes.
In itself.
Yep.
And you can say, like, none of this is fair. And to what I would say to you in that situation is, yeah, man, like, life isn't fair. People have preferences. It's your job in your situation, in your city, at your club, to figure out what it is that you sell better than anybody else, that attracts people in a different way, and figure out who those people are. And it might not be Lionel Messi, and it might not be his squadron of Barca buddies, but that doesn't mean that you can't figure out a way to have success. There's a way forward for every club, and it's not the same as Miami did it, but man, I have to give credit to Inter Miami for seeing in their mind's eye this possibility and not just sitting around drinking red wine and imagining it, finding a way to get it done.
Using that all of the above approach, from Messi to Yannick Bright to Ian Frey to Sergio Busquets and Diego Gomez, it was all on display. Let's talk about the game.
All right, let's do it. How did Inter Miami win the Supporters' Shield, Doyle? Tell me.
Over the course of the year, it was everything you just said. Over the course of 90 minutes last night, it was having the greatest player of all time score two goals that are, I don't want to say only he scores, but only he scores those goals with regularity. The ball over the top, he brings it down perfectly. Obviously, we didn't have the right angle to see whether there was any kind of handball. Considering it's Messi, I'm going to assume there wasn't. I'm going to assume this was just him being magical and then taking those two touches, shedding two defenders and wrong-footing Patrick Schulte on one. And then the second, Suarez sort of buys a foul. I did not think that was a foul at all, but it puts Leo Messi in a place where he can win the game. And then the third goal is Columbus make a bad mistake. And if you make a mistake around Luis Suarez, the man has 600 career goals. He's going to put the ball in the back of the net. And like for once against Columbus, that was enough. Because we've seen this team give Columbus problems twice this year now. And twice this year, Columbus came back to win. Once this year they came back to win.
Correct. Two meetings, correct. Up 2-0 in all three games.
Correct.
In the end, Miami win 2. They win both in the league, by the way. This is how you win the Supporters' Shield, 2-1.
And Columbus won Miami. The League's Cup. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So this is how you win the league. And, you know, Taylor Twellman tweeted today, and I agree with him, that the way to put the crew under pressure is to play direct and to get their center backs running backwards. And Miami has found a way to do that consistently, whether it's those chipped balls over the top or it's when they turn the ball over, pushing forward to advance their numbers and put a little pressure on the crew. I thought the difference in this game wasn't who was the better team. Like if you were just in a vacuum, who played better soccer? The Columbus Crew, to me, played better, more aesthetic soccer, created better chances on the night. But the difference is Inter Miami are ruthless. And if you make mistakes against Inter Miami will almost always find a way to punish you. And the crew just made a laundry list of errors in this game. Just big-time errors. I mean, we'll start from the beginning. Max Arfston, the step over, unnecessary. God, I love Max Arfston. Like, don't take that out of your game, Max. But in that case, just release the ball.
He's hit the wall a little bit, Max Arfston, past 3 weeks.
And understandably so. This is his first year as a full-time starter. Cucho is offside, and Cucho finishes that play. It's a wonderful finish. That would be a momentum-changing moment. There's a botched offside trap that leads to that messy goal. Camacho's got his hand up. Edmonton had dropped in behind him. They just got their line wrong. And when you have Alba and you have Messi trying to take advantage of that error, I mean, ask anybody in La Liga what happens. That's what happens. And then the Camacho foul on Suarez, I agree, it's not a foul. But part of your job as a defender is to know who you're defending.
Don't let the ref decide that game right there.
Don't put that. Okay. If you want to put it on the ref, put it on the ref. But it's Luis Suarez and you bumped him in the back. What do you think Luis Suarez is going to do? You have to defend players in different ways. And Camacho, that's just not a smart moment in that moment. Then the miscommunication. I don't know if it's Schulte. I don't know if it's Camacho. Camacho clearly is not hearing Schulte as he's coming out. They run into each other. I mean, that's just like yakety sack stuff. And Suarez, of course, heads the ball into the back of the net. Camacho gets a second yellow card. And it almost didn't matter because even with Camacho off the field and the crew at 10, it's still 9v9 for 85% of the game because Messi's watching just like I am. He's just walking around on the field waiting for his moment. And then they have a chance to tie it and Cucho misses his penalty. So there are all these mistakes from Columbus. All these things that in the playoffs, that's not going to fly. And Wilfried Nancy knows that and the players know that as well. And in the game, that's what cost them. That was it. And then there's some luck here, Doyle, too, because crew fans are in my ear right now and I can hear them just from all the Twitter interactions last night yelling, yeah, but Sergio Busquets should have seen red.
I agree with them, by the way. And you're the man who does instant replay every week. So
No, you start. You tell me why you agree. Because I'm not saying that you're wrong. That's not at any time where I'm coming from on referee decisions. The laws are the laws, but they're gray and they're interpreting in the moment. It's like a live document basically that you've got to interpret in a very, very fast plays on a soccer field.
High boot, late. And studs into the other guy's legs.
Okay, let's go through that. First of all, the late is where I would start you. Who wins the ball on this play? A 50-50 ball.
Was it not Farsi?
Nope, it was Sergio Busquets who clears the ball.
I got to rewatch it again.
So Farsi is, if you're just going on, look, and this is, it's all technicalities, but Farsi is technically second to the ball on this play. He doesn't get into the ball. Sergio Busquets clears it. Second, you say high boot. Do you think that challenge, that clearance, winning the ball by Sergio Busquets, do you think that's a reckless clearance, or do you think that's a natural way to play that particular ball, which in this 50-50 situation, final man basically, Sergio Busquets has to win? Or like, do you think it's unnatural? Do you think it's like endangering the safety or reckless or something that you would say that's outside the realm of a normal soccer play to me?
I mean, it was right on the edge.
Okay. I think that's fine.
Like, I think I'm rewatching it right now. And
would you say it's above his waist, for instance?
Yes. Yep.
How far?
It's belly button height.
Okay. So it's basically waist. It's basically waist high. Okay, I hear you on that one. Here's what I would say. Reason why initially Drew Fisher pulls his yellow card is to give a yellow card to Mo Farsi for being late, for being second into this challenge. I would ask you this as well within the context of this moment. What's more responsible for the contact in this situation? And let's not mince words. The point of contact is ugly. It's not what you want to see. It is foot. There's studs into the thigh. So that is ugly. There's no doubt about it. And I'm just like most people out there. When I saw it the first time, my brain was screaming red card. What contributes more to that collision in that moment? Busquets' challenge or Farsi's momentum bringing him into the play?
I think it's both. Right. I think yep. with both it's guys, fair. It's their momentum bringing them into the play. It's just, I mean, Busquets has his leg. He has his foot belly button height.
Does he lunge? Do you think he lunges in any way? Or
no,
is this just part of a clearance motion with his laces? He's kicking the ball away.
Let me look again.
This is hard, man. And this is why we're doing this exercise. I'm telling you right now, I spent 40 minutes basically looking at this play and just arguing with myself.
I get what you're getting at. My gut was that this was a red card because you have the high boot and you have the exposed studs. I'm guessing you're about to tell me that it was not a red card.
Yeah, for me, it's not a red card. For me, Sergio Busquets is making a normal play on a 50-50 ball that he has to make a play on that ball. Like, we can't take that moment out of soccer and say, well, you're just not allowed to challenge for a ball that you can very clearly win. And you did win. For me, in a normal clearance motion. There's no lunge. There's no push into the player. There's no intent to, or no thought of like, when I do this, I'm going to hit the player. I don't think Busquets is looking at Farsi and saying, I'm going to get this guy with my studs. I think he's saying, I'm going to clear the ball and bang, it's a coming together. And ultimately, Farsi is second.
So then, how
and
is
raises,
that?
And by the way, Farsi raises his how is leg that different into the from, challenge.
How is that different from Camacho's?
Oh, it's much different.
Sorry, Farsi did not raise his leg above his waist.
I didn't say raise it above his wrist. I'm saying
so there's a difference.
He's challenging for the ball, just like
this is what I. This is why I refuse. This is why I refuse to do instant replay. I hate talking about ref interpretation.
We'll end it here. The Camacho one is much different because Camacho leaves his feet, lunges with his studs exposed with a straight leg, and carries through the legs of Redondo. It's just on good fortune that he doesn't catch Redondo. If he catches Redondo in any way, this is a red card. It's a much different manner of challenge, and the context around the challenge is different. If you took that Busquets situation, and Busquets is running at Farsi and Farsi at Busquets, and Busquets jumps to clear the ball with his studs into Farsi, knowing that he is going to endanger the safety of his opponent when he does that, I'd have a different opinion. But that's not the context around that play. And Crew fans, you can continue to be upset at me. Yeah, look, other big moments in the game. The Cucho missed penalty. That was disappointing. It was really disappointing because
I just thought he was a Drake Callender fan.
I agree. I just thought Cucho was cash. He had already done it once in the game. He went to the same spot too.
At that point, right? Do you maybe let Diego Rossi step up and take the penalty instead?
Why? Because he'd already made one.
Yeah. You don't want to give the goalkeeper two looks.
I don't know, man. That feels like overthinking it. It feels like hindsight. I mean, tricking yourself. That's your best player. That's your leader. That's your guy. Don't you want him to have that moment? He just didn't respond in it.
Yeah.
But Drake Callender did. That's two cups, Doyle, now that Drake Callender has been the final victorious, game-shifting, winning moment.
Two trophies. Remember, this is a dinner plate, not a cup.
Yeah, it's a good point.
But this goes back to the roster build, and this goes back to why we praise both Chris Henderson and Tata Martino, right? Because it's Chris Henderson who has put much of this roster together and given Tata Martino talent 1 through 30 to use in situations like this. And Tata has done an incredible job of player development. Drake Callender is a much better goalkeeper than he was 2 years ago. Guys like Ian Frey and Noah Allen starting on the road in this game, and they weren't perfect, but they were pretty damn good considering the attack that they're facing off against. It's awesome to see. I was telling Anders before the show, Drake Callender reminds me a little bit of young Stefan Fry. He can make some mistakes, right? He's not perfectly clean, but he's always brave. He is always willing to make himself big and take a little bit of physical pounding in situations you maybe see some other goalkeepers shy away from a little bit. And then in these big moments with trophies on the line, I can't name three goalkeepers in the league right now I'd rather have than Drake Callender. And he showed it again. Look, I do think Miami would have won the Shield anyway, even if Cucho had buried that penalty. Miami just wins the Shield this weekend instead. So it's not like a real do-or-die moment like it was in a final in League's Cup last year. But it was a big moment. It was a big moment, and he's starting to stack those. And it's another big reason that they keep winning stuff.
I don't want to be this guy, San Jose Earthquakes supporters. I have to be. Do you know, Doyle, how Miami acquired Callender?
Oh, God. They traded for a bag of balls, right?
Well, even worse, unfortunately. 2020 MLS Super Draft. Inter Miami acquired Callender's homegrown player rights from the San Jose Earthquakes in exchange for the 27th draft pick and potentially up to $150,000 in GAM. He was a San Jose Earthquakes homegrown. Add him to the list.
Look, they chose JT Marcinkowski over him, and JT Marcinkowski was a really good goalkeeper before the injuries. I just don't understand why Quakes management, and to be fair, that was Jesse Fiorinelli era, and he's gone. He's long gone. I don't understand why they had an either or approach to guys like, do we sign Drake Callender or JT Marcinkowski? Do we sign Cade Cowell or Diego Luna? Dummy, sign both.
Yeah, I know. I know. And if you do that, then you don't have guys that are saying, hey, my best bet is to leave. Fidel Barajas, etc. When there's opportunity, people want to take advantage of that and see a path for themselves. Anyway, we'll keep it going here. Was this the biggest regular season game of all time in MLS? Yes or no?
I'm going to say yes. It ends up being that because it's Lionel Messi winning a supporter shield, winning the best trophy, domestic trophy that there is to win in MLS, and doing it at a team that I still think they play the best soccer I've ever seen in MLS. They need to add one more trophy to really be in that greatest team ever convo. But to do it at the Crew, a team with a guy in Cucho who is one of the handful of best center forwards we've had in this league, the amount of talent that was on the field. What else is in the running? The finale 10 years ago,
yeah.
Bruce rested Robbie Keane.
Yeah, Sounders Galaxy. And you might be able to say, hey, we're going to combine those two games because I went back-to-back, I believe. Like, in that, there were games back-to-back to decide the shield between the two teams. And those were iconic, historic MLS teams.
Yep.
I agreed at the beginning of the game that probably it was that Sounders Galaxy one because it's decision day, it's a supporter shield in the balance, and you know, again, the players on the field, the coaches involved are legends.
Bruce did not care about the supporter shield.
That's one tick against it. The other thing is just, it's messy.
Yeah.
It's messy.
And the other one would have been the Red Bulls beating Atlanta in 2018. I think it was end of September. Agreed.
It was in, I think it was September 30th.
And this was in 2018 was as close as 2014, but it was the first time that both teams really cared about the supporter shield. Yep. They were both throwing everything they had at it, and the Red Bulls won that one. I think that was actually a bigger game in context than the 2014 game. And this is bigger than that.
Yeah. Remember, the winners of those regular season shields did not win in the playoffs. Sounders lost to the Galaxy in the playoffs in 2014. Sorry, Anders. I know this is tough for you to relive. And then obviously, Atlanta beat the New York Red Bulls in that 2018 season. So we'll see. We'll see what that means for the playoffs. I will say that I pray that we get Crew Miami again in the playoffs. Of course, if we do, we'll get it in Miami because Miami will only play the rest of the way, I guess, two road games at Toronto this weekend and then that second game of the first round.
You're going to get Orlando, Cincinnati in the Eastern Conference Finals, and you're going to like
don't
it.
Don't you dare. Not even a knock against Orlando, Cincinnati, but just it's hard to imagine. What's the moment that you're going to remember the most from this night? Not necessarily like, oh, well, you know, nitty gritty soccer stuff, but just like, what will we remember about the night?
The messy goals, man. He's the greatest athlete I've ever seen in any sport. And we're coming to the very end of his career. If we're lucky, we've got two more years with him, I think. And so every great performance at this point is like potentially his last. And this was a great match winning performance from him with a title on the line. And so it's messy. It's messy. No athlete in my lifetime has ever given me as much joy as Lionel Messi has. And I doubt, you know, if I live another 48 years, I doubt that will have changed.
I'm trying to imagine in 48 years, I'm thinking like a Futurama situation, just a floating
Cam
Doyle
Weeby
head.
With his 35th goal of the season.
Oh God, don't even tease me. Don't even tease me. Right now we're watching over here to the side in my basement. We're watching all the highlights from Wednesday night. So that's the type of culture that we're really
cultivating
in this house. Yeah, well, Wyatt says he won't play soccer. He'll quit every time if I try to make him. He likes to play with us, but not on a team. A moment I'm going to remember most, I think, is the Messi interview with Diego Valeri. It's so fortunate for us at MLS Season Pass and just us as a league and as fans of the game and this, you know, these two countries that Diego Valeri chose MLS in Portland to really to make his home and has continued to say, this is where I want to be, because that was the perfect person to interview Lionel Messi. And Messi was as honest and open and I guess emotional. He doesn't really get like that much with Diego as I think we could have seen him after this match. It was an extended interview in Messi terms, And just the way he talked about the overall season, the accomplishments, how proud he was of not just like himself and like his buddies, that core group, but of the entire organization and his entire team and all the players around him and what they had put in to get this done, really just made you feel sort of like, oh, I get it. I get why this guy wins so much. One, he's blindingly brilliant himself. But two, this is what he lives for. Like this moment of winning something, of celebrating, of having a group accomplish the highest thing that they can accomplish together and then having the payoff. And the other thing was, and this is the true sicko in both myself and Lionel Messi speaking, he straight up recited the playoff format, Doyle. Everybody out there who said, oh, we can't figure out what this the playoff
was,
format
this
is.
This was Weeby's highlight. This is the highlight of Weeby's year.
A three-game series is beyond my capacity to understand. Lionel Messi stood up and just walked you through it step by step. If Lionel Messi knows the playoff format by heart and has no issue with it, I think we can all grasp it and figure it out. But that was like, oh, this dude knows ball. This guy's a sicko. I like that. But I also know that Messi knows MLS Cup is the ultimate prize. There is one small prize first. It's the points record, the all-time points record. If they win their final two games.
I don't think that's a small prize. I think that's
at Toronto, New England at home. Do they capture that prize?
At this point, yeah. Yep. At Toronto, we kind of went through it. They look dead in the water right now. And New England don't have much more fight than that either. I would be surprised. I'm back to being surprised if Miami don't pull it off. One other moment I want to shout out from last night. Our good friend Julian Sakovic had a post-game interview with Ian Frey.
Oh, yes.
And Ian Frey, if you remember, he tore his ACL against, was it Cruz Azul, in Messi's first game for Inter Miami. And
his
Messi,
third ACL tear, by the way.
And he's only 22.
Yep.
And Messi, after that game, dedicated the win to Ian Frey, who he'd probably met like three times in his life at that point.
And met might have been a strong word for right. it, you know?
And afterwards, after this game, Jill was able to get Ian Frey for a couple minutes, and he's a homegrown. And, you know, he has been around Inter Miami since before Inter Miami was an MLS team, and now he gets to play with the greatest player of all time. And he gave a really, I thought, thoughtful and emotional interview, and you know he dedicated the season and the win to Messi, and like that's I guess it's corny, but I thought that was really great, and I thought that sort of touched all sides of what MLS is and what can make this league special when it's done right.
And Jorge Mas, the owner, jumped in on the interview and gave Ian Frey his flowers. Because Frey has had big-time moments. Remember, Frey scored a goal in the 2-1 win from a corner kick. I believe that was his first goal since yep. coming back. So in two games against Columbus, he scored a winning goal. Or might have been the opening goal in that game. I take that back. He scored a goal. That's good enough. And then he helped usher a back line against this Crew team to win the Shield. Pretty incredible stuff. Real quick, the Columbus perspective. What did this mean? This is a huge disappointment. And the second disappointment for them at home, in a couple week span there because of Copa America and Campeones Cup. And they had lost, I think, two games in 40 at lower.com coming into this one. The Shield's up in smoke, but you know, they have the solace that there'll probably will be another opportunity if they perform.
Yeah, I think it's just when you play that many big games against great teams, you're bound to lose a couple, but Cliff Slaughterbeck on social media sent me this. Columbus's record against teams with less than 1.5 points per game is 13 wins, 7 draws, 2 losses for 46 points. The record against teams greater than 1.5 points per game is 3 wins, 2 draws, 4 losses, 11 points. Beating up on bad opponents is not a recipe for being the best MLS team of all time. 2 of their 3 wins against opponents with more than 1.5 points per game are against Orlando. Of course, those came for the one of those came before Orlando have turned into this juggernaut that they are now with Martin Ojeda as the number 10. I'm going to say that's partially telling. I think the argument for Columbus is that in knockout tournament games, MLS Cup, CONCACAF Champions Cup, Leagues Cup, and even against Club America, They're almost impossible to beat. Club America didn't beat them. They beat them on penalties. Like that's a draw. Obviously, Club America hoists the trophy, and like that's a bummer for Columbus. But like, if you watch that game back, I think it was pretty even between those two teams. And I think going into the postseason, Columbus are going to be a little bit more rested than they are now, and hopefully they will have Sean Zawadzki back and be able to put their best 11 out there. I would not be at all surprised if Columbus went to Miami and beat Miami in the Eastern Conference Final, should both teams make it. I think Columbus is that good. But now they've got to show it.
We've talked a lot about RSL and Andres Gomez and that sale and how it sort of threw a little upheaval into RSL's squad. I think there's more upheaval with RSL in their summer changes than the Crew. But moving Aiden Morris out of the team, remember when they did all that in CONCACAF Champions Cup? That's Aiden Morris and Darlington Nagbe. Aiden Morris just brought something different.
I think Zawadzki was really, really good.
I'm not discounting Sean Zawadzki.
I think the delta between Zawadzki and Morris wasn't particularly big.
Okay, but here's the trickle down. When Zawadzki's hurt, now it's Matan playing in that spot, as opposed to if Morris is hurt, now it's Zawadzki. Or if you have an issue at the outside center back spot, then it's Zawadzki. Like it reduces your options when you start to stack up big games, big moments, and injuries inevitably pop in.
And I will agree with that, especially when you look at the performances of Darlington Nagbe and Steven Marrera over the past few weeks. Like both those guys are kind of lacking the burst that we saw from them through League's Cup. They've just stacked up too many minutes. And if Morris was still there, you could give Nagbe 2 weeks of rest and just play Morris and Zawadzki in central midfield. If Morris was still there, Nagbe and Morris in midfield, play Zawadzki at right back, you know, and give Marrera some rest. And they just haven't been able to do that. And it's no knock on the roster build, though. It is maybe it's another thing that you kind of look at Miami and you could praise them for, because they have been able to go down the depth chart and keep guys fresh and deal with injuries in a way that we've never seen from any team in MLS before.
Does that depth and the fact that Lionel Messi has only played, what is this now, 16 games, 1,420 something minutes, does that preclude Lionel Messi from winning the MLS MVP award, Doyle? I was on Wrap Up with Sasha Kleshin last night, and he said, anyone who votes for Messi is not a serious person. And I told Sasha that he's likely at the end of the season, when the votes are counted and the award is given out, to be surrounded by people in clown masks. He's going to be like Scar in Lion King. I am surrounded by idiots, because Lionel Messi has 17 goals and 15 assists, 32 goal contributions, just one behind Evander in 800 less minutes than Evander. And yes, he hasn't played more than half a season, but also, by God, he's only played half a season and look what he's done. At this exact moment, I would still vote Cucho, and more on MLS Player of the Year all competitions vibes than MLS MVP vibes. But I find it incredibly hard to believe, almost impossible to believe, that at the end of this process, and the votes are counted and tabulated and a winner is crowned, that it will not be Lionel Messi. I cannot see the voters not going that direction.
The voters are going to vote for Messi. And that
by the way, players, club staff, so that's coaches, technical staff, and then media. Those are the voting blocks.
Right. And they're going to vote for Messi because he is the best player in the league and he is the best player of all time. And I don't disagree with that. I'm going to have trouble voting for someone who's played half the minutes available.
What is MVP to you, then? Like, just help me understand as you sit down to put your votes on quote-unquote paper, paper.
It's a combination of individual excellence, team excellence, and importance to the team. Look.
How is that weighted? Like how much does team excellence play a role? Because that's really going to be a big one for all these other players.
It rules out Evander. It rules out Christian Benteke, both of whom have been excellent this year. Individual excellence, super important. Like you have to be one of the three or four best players in the league. And then importance to the team is, I'm not going to say it's a third, but it's a lot. And Miami have virtually identical points per game with Messi and without Messi. It's not to say they're not a better team with him. Clearly they are. But they have virtually identical points per game with and without the greatest player of all time. LAFC can survive without Denny Bawanga. We saw Columbus survive without Cucho when he was suspended, and he's played fewer than 2,000 minutes. Cincinnati are a point behind Columbus, and without Lucho Acosta, Cincinnati would be a 40-point team. I still have Lucho atop my MVP ballot.
And that's where you would vote. Despite the fact that Lucho's momentum has sort of petered off, his production has gone away.
Oh, Weeby, I have the ability to remember things that happened 6 months ago.
Boy, you're not a typical voter. you are upper top echelon voter there, Doyle. You're educated, you're tuned into the current events.
What would LAFC be if they were just starting Bawanga and Kike Oliveira on the wings? They'd still be a really good team.
Yeah.
What would LAFC or LA Galaxy be without Ricky Pooch? Like, we've had people argue they'd be a better team because they would have better structure and put more of the game on the foot of Gabriel Peck and Joseph Paintsil. What would Miami be without Lionel Messi? Well, we have half a season's worth of data.
We have half a season's worth, and I agree with you. But I would argue that to ask Miami to be this, to be an all-time team, to be a points record threat, to be a Supporters Shield champion, I think if you take Messi out of the equation, I don't care that they did it for half a season. I don't think they do it for a full season.
I mean, you're probably right, but that's a hypothetical.
Isn't it always a hypothetical? Any MVP, there's a hypothetical. Because we don't know what they would be without them.
Yeah, but
right? Most MVPs, we just don't know.
We've seen these teams without them. Like, we know what Miami is without Messi.
Okay, but devil's advocate. We also know what they are with him. And here's what the issue is. We know that number one, he's the best player in the league. We know that number two, people will vote for him because he's Lionel Messi. And they don't have I think that the issue is they don't have that credible, yes, slam dunk alternative where it's like, you know what? That's Lionel Messi and he's had a wonderful half season, but this guy, Sebastian Giovinco, or this guy, Carlos Vela, had a generational season that matches up in terms of numbers. Their team is great, and they have been a blinding light of individual and collective brilliance that their team could not thrive without. We don't think you have that alternative, and that's unfortunate because Chicho could have been.
Lucho's doing that.
Lucho's having a great year, man.
Nobody has ever had 10 goals and 20 assists in a season.
Okay.
Lucho's at what, 13 and 19? 14 and 19?
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with the numbers.
Anyway.
I'm not going to argue with the numbers.
I still have Lucho number one. I know that it does not matter at all. If Lionel Messi appears on the ballot, Lionel Messi is going to win MVP, and I promise you, I will not complain about it.
That's a vote for Ralph Nader right there. I'm just messing with you.
Well, you just opened up a very old wound.
Oh, man. I mean, look, right now, I'm. If you said, you shoved me in a voting booth and said you have to vote, I would vote Cucho. I just think, and I would do it not based solely on MLS, though I think he's been brilliant in MLS. I would do it based on the entirety of this year for Cucho, all competitions, all moments. I just think that this particular moment against Miami was one where he could have really solidified himself. Yeah, I know, Andres, that's not the award. But you're telling me how the award works. People want to debate valuable. They want to, like, everybody just has to do it their own prism.
Anders is about to cut your mic.
What's the alternative then? If I'm not voting Cucho, you're probably voting Messi.
Yep.
Mute.
Yeah, he cut your mic.
It is what it is. It is what it is, man. We'll see what happens. There's still 2 weeks left. There's still plenty that could change, storylines that could be written, big goals to be scored. Cucho, Evander, Benteke, Buongo, Luis Suarez even, Lucho, Chicho. Well, Chicho's probably out. And Messi. Let us know. Who would you vote for? As we finish up here, let's go through some of the other races, big stories, results from Wednesday night. Eastern Conference wildcard race is probably the craziest sort of storyline to follow through decision day. There are still, I guess, I'd call it six teams in the running in the Peloton of mediocrity. Doyle, Montreal on 40 points in eighth. They're at Charlotte, then home against New York City. Toronto just below on 37. They're above the line on tiebreaker. They just have Miami left at home. Philadelphia on 37. It's been a disappointing couple of results for Philly. Draw against Atlanta and then to lose to Orlando. They're at Columbus and Cincinnati at home. That's super rough. DC have it pretty easy. 37 points at New England. Charlotte at home, and we won't even mention Atlanta and Nashville until they get a little higher up the standings. Right now on 34 and 33 points, respectively. Who you got? Who's going to jump in?
I think Montreal is going to hold on to it. I think Toronto are probably done. Looking at the schedule.
DC's schedule.
Right? DC is so much easier than Philadelphia. DC's at New England and home to Charlotte. Philly are at Columbus and home to Cincinnati. And look, historically, I don't want to say historically, like over the past year under Troy Lessain, 8 months under Troy Lessain, anytime they've gotten on a good run, it feels like their legs have just gone out from under them real quick. We're used to them falling short, letting us down. We saw it in Leagues Cup too, where they were playing really well, got a stupid red card, and they were out of that tournament. But over their last 9 games in MLS, they're 5-2-2. They started defending a little bit better. They have in Benteke, the guy who's going to win the Golden Boot. Gabriel Pirani has turned into a good secondary scoring option. Still not much of a creator, but he can put the ball in the back of the net. Ted Kudu-Pietro has started salvaging a broken and felt like it was a lost season a little bit. I'm not saying I fully believe in DC United, but they've mostly played good soccer this year and lost the game in moments.
And they give up a lot of moments, and they gave up a lot against Nashville.
They do. But in the end, they won, and they have that schedule, and it's like so much easier than the Unions. I don't know, man.
Troy Lessain was pretty emotional on the field after that win, and I get it. He must have really gone through it. I mean, that was their playoff lives, basically, and to come back from 3-2 down away and get that win was massive. And you just can't say enough about Christian Benteke. It's not just the assist and then the goals that he scores. It's just the gravity. Like on that Pirani winner, he doesn't make a run. He just takes a couple steps closer in toward goal, and the defenders all take steps with him, and that opens the exact lane for the ball to pop out to Pirani. It just, his gravity all year has been a huge difference maker for this DC side. Big Saturday. And then also some Sunday games this weekend to decide some of these spots and some of the jockeying for positions ahead of the international break. Couple games in there, then decision day. All right, race for the East number 4 seed. I'm just going to give you teams. You tell me what you're thinking right now. Orlando City, they took down Philly 2-1.
Pretty easily the fourth best team in the Eastern Conference. Just we've seen it ever since Martin Ojeda was moved to the starting lineup. He from the jump in this game, he was so good and put Philly on the back foot almost by himself. And it's almost sad that he didn't factor into the scoring because he was the best player on the field for the first hour. And then Orlando eventually broke that down. And
can I just say, Luis Muriel is starting to have some moments.
Yeah. Well, coming off the bench, right? Yeah, and remember, yeah, that's what his role was.
And as a distributor.
That's what his role was with Atalanta. He was an attacking super sub, and maybe there's something to that because he's looked comfortable and he has opened games up.
That pass to Big Dunk was freaking perfect. The pace on that ball, the shape on it was wonderful. Alonso Martinez, New York City roll on. Their residency at Red Bull Arena continues to be a resounding success. A win against Cincinnati. Are NYCFC convincing you that they're back to what they should be, or is this a mirage?
It's not a mirage. I think that, you know, they're probably going to end up facing Orlando in that 4-5 game. And like the difference, like NYCFC could win that. They could absolutely win that. They have enough talent to do so, but there's just, they're still a young team in a lot of ways. So the up and down nature of their season is not something I expect to just go away.
Red Bulls. No better way to bounce back than to go to Toronto and see Bernadeschi sent off and Toronto implode and give away terrible penalties. And hey, Emil Forsberg is back. So have we pushed the bad taste of the Harrison Blues out of our mouth, or are we still doubters on the Red Bulls?
I'm still doubting the Red Bulls. I think you need more than one, I guess two special players, because Lewis Morgan has earned that over the past couple of years. You need match winners, and I don't think that they have that to the level of these other teams. But if Forsberg is back and healthy and committed, then they'll look more like the team they were through the first 3 months of the season, and that team was pretty good.
Charlotte FC, the DPs are firing, Doyle, but the defense gave up 3 goals.
Yeah, I don't
not happy. Not happy yeah. about some of the offside calls in that game. That's neither here nor there, but I'll do that in instant replay. We don't got to bore you with that sort of conversation here. But hey, the DPs are firing.
So what made Charlotte tough the first half of the year was they played with 3 super aggressive field coverage oriented central midfielders. They didn't play with a true playmaker, and now they have a true playmaker out there, and Pep Biel's starting to look like a really good attacking player, but you have to carry him a little bit defensively. They haven't figured out how to do that. They haven't figured out how to stay compact and tough to play against when they drop a piano carrier for a piano player. I don't know what that's going to mean. I suspect, though, given the way that Dean Smith approaches the game, that Pep Biel is not going to be a starting central midfielder come playoff time, that he's more likely to be sort of a playmaking winger on one
side. It's that right wing, I think, right?
Yeah.
It's Biel on one side and Abad on the other. And then it looks like Swiderski, 2 goals were cathartic for him in this match. And then you go back to that 3 in the midfield that can give you structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
but even for that. I should say, even with that, last night, because they had Junior Urso out there and Brant Bronico in front of Ashley Westwood, even with that last night, they still looked a little bit lost in a way that is concerning.
All right. Race for the 4 seed is done in the East. We're going to figure that out over the course of the next few weeks. But let's talk about just overall the West, because there's no real playoff races left. It's just all seeding. Let's do some stock up, stock down. Stock up, Minnesota, Doyle. I know it's a scoreless draw at RSL, but it's a draw on the road. That'll work just fine in the playoffs. And Minnesota just had their best performance of the year under Eric Ramsey against Colorado. Feels to me like they are absolutely stock up. And the Sounders are stock up and climbing the standings currently, all the way up to 3rd in the Western Conference on 53 points, could even conceivably, if LAFC drop points, pass LAFC and get into 2nd.
The Sounders have been the best team in the league in terms of points per game since Jordan Morris was moved to the number 9. And he had 2 assists in this one.
Better than Orlando.
Yes. Yep.
Nice.
And
better than Miami.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. They have been a dominant team since midseason, since that move. The issue is, do they have enough top-end talent, guys who can win the game in moments, to beat a team like LAFC in the playoffs? And I think it's an open and unanswered question, though Anders is swearing up and down in the chat that it's Paul Rothrock, that Paul Rothrock is that guy. I don't think so, but, maybe I'll be wrong.
Stock up, LAFC. It was not a vintage win against St. Louis, but it was a win, and Denny Bawanga had a couple big-time Denny Bawanga moments. They just won a championship. They're in 2nd place. Stock up.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that, though. I need to see them get fully fit and healthy. I need to see Jesus Murillo back. I need to see Eddie Atuesta back. Hopefully, for the sake of it being a good and memorable playoffs, hopefully those guys will both be good to go come decision day and beyond.
it does look like Giroux is starting to figure out how he fits in and how he can best sort of elevate his teammates while also getting his own. He had a goal called off for offside. It was correct, but had some good moments in this game. Stock down, the Rapids, Doyle, stock down. That's three losses in four games and kind of bad losses too. What's happening with this team?
I think that we're seeing maybe the extended League's Cup run catch up with them. They've been a little slow to close down, especially through midfield. I thought they were disorganized through midfield.
Big gaps. That's something you didn't see from this Armas team in their best moments. They were very, very compact.
And the same thing has happened to RSL a little bit over the past month and a half, 2 months. I think it happens, especially when there's personnel changes and, you know, Cole Bassett being out. He was out again last night, right?
Yes. I believe that to be the case.
Cole Bassett is their best pressing player, right? He is the guy who really understands the shape, I think, better than anybody else. So it kind of makes sense a little bit, but maybe, you know, as the games get tighter, as the stakes get a little higher down the stretch here, the little differences, the little margins start to matter more. And you take away Moise Bambito, who was a security blanket with his ability to put out fires in the open field. And now Bassett is hurt. And now maybe Hafa Navarro and Georgie have logged a lot of minutes and they're closing down a little bit more slowly. Sam Vines wasn't great before his injury, but Sam Vines has been injured. It all starts to add up. And then look, congratulations to Zach Steffen on being called back into the national team, but he doesn't look like a national team keeper to me. He did not cover himself in glory last night.
Vancouver Whitecaps, one win in six games. Vanni Sartini took the L last night personally and said, this one's on me, after that home loss to Seattle in which they could have clinched the Cascadia Cup. This feels like maybe Vancouver returning to earth a little bit.
It does to me. They've tinkered. It's Vanny, so they've tinkered with the formation a little bit. It doesn't look as natural, especially out of possession, right? Like they don't snap into their shape and become difficult to play against the way they were through most of this year. It looks like they're thinking through the steps somewhat. And part of that could just be integrating one new DP. Not that Stuart Armstrong has played a lot, but integrating one new DP while coping for the absence of their other, and Ryan Gold, who is their best player. So it's a bad patch. It's a rough patch. They were bound to have one of those this year. I still like the talent on this team.
Timbers love that talent, especially the attacking talent. Losing at home to Austin as you try to climb the table and get out of the wild card game, or at the very least, play that wild card game in the stadium you just lost in. Phil Neville said, hey, given our form, given what we put into the season, we get a mulligan now and then. That's a bad time to take a mulligan.
Yeah, I mean, it just a shocking loss. Just a shocking loss. And any chance that Evander had at winning MVP is gone.
All right, let's look ahead to the weekend and get on out of here. Let people enjoy their day. What game you got? What are you watching here?
I'm going to go back to DC, right? Because
you're a sicko. You're here. You're just here for the pain.
It's one of those where, okay, like I said, we've gotten used to DC letting us down. Except they're 5-2-2 in their last nine games. They have an easier schedule than the teams around them that are fighting to get into the wild card round. And there's something fun. I like watching Columbus, Miami, the LA Galaxy, the teams that use the ball, Houston. Those are my favorite teams to watch. And sometimes it could be a little jarring to watch DC United. But that kind of makes it fun. And you add on the fact that Christian Benteke has been so massive this year. They can be a good watch. They can be a surprisingly good watch. And with a playoff positioning on the line this weekend.
Hey, last time New England were in New England, weren't they fighting before halftime and Dylan Barrera was getting sent off for double descent?
God, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we get some more of that going on. Or maybe they show up because they got good players too. I don't know. It's a complete mystery with New England. I'm going to take a pair in the Western Conference. We talked about Vancouver and Minnesota. Well, Vancouver are hosting Minnesota, and if Vancouver do not get it done at home, Minnesota could jump them out of the wild card game. So how are those stakes? Pretty high, I would say. And then Colorado-Seattle. Feels like one of those get-right games that Colorado really needs. Big-time opponent, a team they might see in the first round, depending on seeding. A team that is better than them, both in sort of experience and probably roster. But they're at home. And prior to this Galaxy loss, they had won 8 out of 10. They hadn't lost a single time in that space at Commerce City. So this is a moment for Chris Armas to batten the hatches to say, hey, for the second time all year, we lost games back-to-back. Let's not make it 3 in a row for the first time this season and get a win. Or at least get a good performance, because they've been lacking that in this recent stretch.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Looking at 7-8-9 in the Western Conference, how does that shake out? How does that look at the end of the year?
Seven, eight, nine. I think Portland are gonna stay down in nine. The one thing I would say is anytime they go to Seattle, they seem to just get the job done, and that's decision day for them. So I think Portland stay down in nine. I think Minnesota win in Vancouver. They're a very good road team, actually a better road record than Vancouver has a home record. I think Minnesota win in Vancouver, and it's Vancouver-Portland with Minnesota into the seventh seed.
So we'll get a Cascadia Cup matchup in the wild card. I like that.
That was a complete guess. I'm just throwing things at the wall and seeing if they'll stick. Inter Miami will finish fifth.
That's when you're at your best.
Inter Miami will finish fifth. Who knows? What could happen? Well, they're the champions. We know that. And we have a set of games this weekend. We'll be back on Monday to wrap up those games for you and lead you into the international break. In the meantime, thanks for sticking with us, listening to our inane conversation at times, and always some offshoots within. Sorry, San Jose. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Adios. We'll be right back.